Sharath, welcome back to Network Capital. You've been a dear friend, advisor, and a prolific author. Tell us a bit about yourself and why have you written yet another book? Why are you doing this?
I was asking myself that question, Akash, as I was trying to get the book to the finish line, but you know the deal, it's very addictive as a process. You'll mention the book, and I really hope that NC members will enjoy it as well. So just a two-minute summary. I was born in India, in Chennai, came to the UK quite young, grew up in the Middle East, came back, and after a corporate career, spent 15 years as a founder, a social entrepreneur in education. And when I realized that the last venture I ran reached about 50,000 schools, about 35,000 were in India. And I think when I look back to that leadership period, it wasn't this idea that all time was equal, that there were these moments where how I handled and navigated that moment made or break or broke our future for many years to come. A couple of moments I handled well, a couple not so well. And so now in my my new sort of avatar, about 3 years in as a leadership advisor, really trying to focus on those moments, helping leaders navigate that next mountain to climb question, where they go next, how they can be the best they can be, and get a chance to work with a really lovely range of organizations across every major sector. The book was a chance to sort of crystallize some of that learning and hope that many other leaders could benefit from some of the ideas and insights on how to navigate those really important moments in our lives. And yeah, the book is called Inflection.
In your role as a leadership advisor, do you sometimes find it difficult to explain to people that why after INSEAD and Cambridge and top-notch consulting jobs, why are you doing this and what does that entail?
Yeah, I think, Akash, one of the things I realized about being a leader, a CEO, a founder, it's such a tough gig, and being in the ring is very tough. You get punched from all directions, from you know, your team to investors, to boards, to your clients or partners. It's not easy being in the ring. And I think a lot of leaders now are leaving the ring, actually, whether it's a corporate CEO to head teachers or, you know, a GP leader, for example, in a national health service in the UK. And so for me, I think the leadership is fundamentally a noble act, and it's a way to help others reach places they wouldn't have gotten to otherwise, I should say. And so I think I see my real role in this chapter of life to help many leaders really trying to pioneer great change. Yeah, be more successful, box better, and yeah, really retake their organizations, their people to these really amazing places.
You know, there is another person on Network Capital. He used to work at Facebook, and then eventually, I think, left a $1 million job to get into the coaching space. And now he's found his niche, and he's able to do what he does. But it's a daily grind. It's not easy to go through this process. So, what was your inflection like, and how did that weave into this book?
Yeah, so I think I was at a point where I'd been running Stir for about, it was an education venture. It reached about 35,000 schools in India, about 15,000 schools elsewhere by then. I learned a lot. It was an amazing ride, an amazing journey. But I could feel all the classics, founder syndrome symptoms coming up, right? And I felt I could either try and soldier on and try to do what many founders do, which is kind of try to be oblivious to that. Or I could recognize this probably was a good chance to jump out, find a great successor, but also I could again go on that mouse trap and go back onto another venture. I'd done that before, and I felt my energy was really about how can I achieve a more balance in terms of the number of other people I help and support. You know that I had a lot of people around me, but I found those moments very difficult to navigate nonetheless. And there's a karmic sense of, I wish I'd had that support when I faced those moments. So could I be that person for other leaders as well? I think that was probably a fundamental driver in some ways.
Most people on Network Capital come here for some amount of career transition, career coaching, career support, building their networks, so on and so forth. In other words, inflection is something they really aspire for. How should young leaders and CXOs and CEOs think about inflection points in their career, and how can they better prepare for it?
I think the first idea in the book, Akash, is this idea that we need to recognize an inflection moment. Often it's not obvious. No one slaps us in the face and says, this is it. You've got to look out for what I call the starships and the asteroids, right? Things that are happening in our external environment. That's the asteroid. Things that might be happening within you or within your company or organization. That's the starship. So first, recognizing those moments when they arise, and realizing that you need to navigate those differently from day-to-day work. It's not about execution. You've got to step back for a bit and think about how that consciously. And what makes inflection moments so tough to navigate is you need to balance time frames. You've got to think about where will I, if it's a career question. So I teach one of the most popular electives at Said Business School in Oxford, and that's influenced the book a lot. This first question of like, what is my 10-year view? When I make this crossroads decision, maybe it's about a career change, let's say. What will this mean for 10 years out? What would that mean? What would my perspective be 10 years from now? How will I look back at that decision? I think of that like the hour hand of a watch, that long-term piece. The minute hand question is, well, how will I nurture my potential towards that hour hand, towards that direction? The second hand question is about, will I stay motivated and resilient on the ride? How can I boost those drivers and motivation? And how do I keep the watch dial moving? How do I keep learning along that journey? So I think that's what makes inflection moments so tough, is we've got to balance. It's got to be right in the short term. Maybe we've got debt. We're finishing an MBA. We're £100,000 in debt, which sounds like some of our colleagues might well be soon on the call. How do I balance that need with the desire to really self-actualize, to find something I really love doing? And it's that question of how do you navigate those time frames that makes that exciting and challenging. And that's what the book is really there to help us do.
So this assumes that people are thinking about their careers or have a general sense of where they want to go. Have you encountered people in your teaching or your coaching or people that perhaps you invest or support in that haven't quite figured out where they want to take their lives? And how might people think about inflection in such a state?
Yeah, it's a very common a common scenario, right? A lot of us have also taken time, and gosh, I'm sure both you and I, to find that piece. My advice is, I think what can happen sometimes when we're a little bit lost is we go down what I call a career capture mindset. We start thinking, okay, what's the hot job right now? Is it investment banking versus tech or consulting? Or and that is very difficult to play now, given how fast the labor market is moving. What may be hot now may not be hot 5 years from now or 10. That's the problem with the time horizons, right? So what I encourage leaders to do if they're in that situation is to think about not about a career, but a problem they're really interested in. It might be climate tech, it might be the future of AI on health, it might be how do we open up our democracy, for example. It doesn't have to be a big social problem. It can be a very, what's the future of regulation in banking, for example. But a wicked problem where there is no easy solution and there's no technical solution, there's no right answer. The reason is that allows us to first of all get lost in a problem bigger than ourselves. So we forget ourselves, we become less self-conscious. That whole question of imposter syndrome is less relevant then. But also we can carve different career paths along that. So let's say it's climate tech. You might start working in a climate consulting firm, just giving an example. You might then become an investor, you might become an executive, you might become a coach later on. There's a number of career things that will open up, but in a way, if we can really focus on the problem, what makes us interested in it, we really go all in. We develop new muscles, we develop new connections, and we're much more likely to reach our potential that way around.
Very well said. And this career captures happens all the time. There's always a hot new job that everyone seems to be going after. And it happens with frenzy at top business schools because everyone suddenly gets interested in one thing, which makes it more competitive. And we can get into elements of mimetic theory and this and that. But yeah, top business schools, in a way, can be breeding grounds of people looking at hot new things, going after them, thinking that this is their destiny. But they are sometimes just following their neighbor's dream, which we on Network Capital try to just caution them against. So, do you want to give us a few examples from your book or from your experience of people, organizations, and institutions who've looked at inflection well? And what are some of the lessons that we can learn from them?
Yeah, great question, Akash. Let me give a personal example, an example of a person and an example of an organization. So when I was teaching in Oxford, and there's huge credit to them because they realized that in any top business school, as you said, there can be that kind of herd mentality, right? Then have this incredibly diverse group, assembled in Oxford, and suddenly everyone wants to go after three jobs. That happens all the time in any business school. So the idea of this program was to provide a space for leaders to reflect, think about these questions, and navigate that moment. There was one Indian student. She was on the program. Her husband was still in India. And what transpired after being on the program that there were a lot of expectations. There was kind of an expectations triangle in there about expectations of herself, of money, and kind of status and peer pressure that were deeply embedded in identity. And her husband was implicitly expecting her to go into one of literally two jobs after business school. That were the only two noteworthy jobs he would sort of accept. And she didn't want those jobs. When she really introspected, neither of them fit, really felt like they fit her. And she felt almost the sense of sort of being a chameleon, and that she wasn't being true to herself, authentic to herself. I think by being in the course, I remember it was over Christmas, she went back to India and she had a very deep conversation with her husband. And she said, "Look, you're not marrying an MBA, you're marrying a person. And we're living, breathing things, right? We have interests, we're different. The fact that I have this fancy education should not define me any more than I want to define myself." And so seeing that was an amazing thing. And she's taken some very interesting things post business school. An example of an organization I've been working with, the B Lab movement, or the B Corp movement, where companies certify themselves in terms of their social environmental impact, a very, very hot topic right now. They have reached in the UK, and I've been working with the leadership team, 3% of GDP now goes through the B Corp movement. It's amazing how quickly that's happened in a matter of years. But they can continue going as they go. They can try and get to 5% or 6%. They've been very brave, and it's been a privilege working with them and the leadership team. They want to have a more systemic impact, changing how investors behave, how pension regulators, investment managers behave, how legislation behaves. And we're looking at a strategy to really go much deeper and more systemically. And so again, I think both moments, personal or organization, they require courage. They require recognizing what's that crossroads question, but they can be navigated and they can get to great places that really energize us and actually future-proof our success at the same time.
How do you try to future-proof your own success? Do you try to do that as well? Or have you achieved everything in life you wanted to?
I wish I could say yes to that question, Akash. I think part of this is one of the ideas in the book again is trying to avoid looking at fixed goals, right? Because a binary goal where you achieve it or you don't achieve it, a lot of people will say, "I want to make, I don't know, my first million," for example. When I do that, everything will be great. Of course, what happens, we get to the million and then it becomes 2 million or 3 million, or that's if we're lucky to get to any of these numbers, of course. But instead, I think what I'm much more excited about is this idea of mastery and constantly being the best version of myself I can be, getting better each day. So I've learned to look less worry about judging myself or comparing myself to others. I'm a big fan of your category of one concept I talked about in the book. But I think the idea of growth and learning. And so what I love about what I do is I facilitate what I call a guided journey with each of my clients, usually organizations, and seeing how their leaders grow and develop and the new directions the organizations and leaders take is really motivating for me to see what engages, what lands, what resonates, what doesn't. And so every day you keep learning and trying to get better and try to codify that learning through the writing process. And that's the second book. I think this is a much better book than my first one. So again, this idea of just every time trying to get a little bit better at what we do is part of what drives me personally.
And your first book did really well. I hope everyone on Network Capital reads it, the second one, and send you feedback. But I want to just stick on this point a little. My philosophy dissertation is on achievement. And one of the things that makes achievement valuable is difficulty, and like how people consider it a difficult thing to accomplish something. And when there's a lot of literature on this particular subject, on why do people strive for things and so forth, and it comes out over and over again that setting sometimes goals that are hard and achieving them keeps you accountable. That's why people set goals. Once they cross their goal, they're motivated to achieve more goals or become less motivated if they don't. But you're talking about a different philosophical framework, which is looking at practice. The art of pursuing goals, not binary goals, but the practice is what makes the achievement or inflection valuable. It's just pretty hard. It needs a very different kind of discipline, perhaps mentorship, to look at practice as a way to replace these binary goals. How might you answer that?
Yeah, it's great thought, Lukash. So I think one thing is that I think our education systems have trained us to be very binary and look at goals as being very fixed. And actually what I found in every goal that I've set, almost always, whether I meet the goal or don't meet the goal, the journey of learning towards the goal has been much more valuable. So I was talking about, a wonderful moment I got my OBE in the book, where it was a wonderful experience. And yes, it was very, in our language, extrinsic, right? It has a motivation, it was part of an outward reward. But I was reflecting that actually it would have meant nothing.
It's another reward for you.
Yeah,
you
Yeah, no, thank you. But if it hadn't been that internal struggle, it was so tough, that whole journey, it wouldn't have meant anywhere near as much. So it is that sense of the struggle itself is deeply motivating. And if we can be comfortable with that idea of struggling and growing and progressing, we're much more likely to keep at what we do and get better. The other thing I think is that we need every now and then, this is where the inflection moment comes in, to reevaluate our goals and ask, is that the right goal to begin with? And so if we have that chance to say that, let's say, for example, you're in a job where you wanted to get to VP, but you're in a tech company, you might say, well, actually, I've seen the VPs now, I've got a sense of how they work. That's not my role model anymore. I want to go into another place. So giving yourself room to be flexible, but when you're doing something, being all in, because you attract great nurturers around you, you stay motivated. That, I think, is the trick to keep going and really enjoy that day-to-day progress and learning, but also step back from time to time and think about that bigger, what's that next mountain to climb question.
So you're an interesting person that way, because you teach graduate level students at Oxford, which are on the younger side, and then you advise perhaps CEOs, VPs, and older, more experienced people. Now, the challenge with younger people is that we might not have the experience to be able to put life in perspective. So if you don't achieve a particular inflection, it can feel like the end of the world. On the older side, maybe it's different. So what advice would perhaps your students in Oxford give to the executives? And what advice might the executives give to your students?
So a fantastic question, because that's my third book. I'm in the process of writing, actually, literally. It's kind of cool. Okay. It's about that generational piece. But yeah, I mean, what I've been learning so far on this topic is that if you look at the science of regret, right, and what do we regret later in life, as we get older, especially we get towards midlife, our 40s, 50s, almost always the regrets are much more about what we didn't do rather than what we did do. So it's almost always, I wish I'd tried this, even if it didn't work, that's the thing. So what I would say with that time horizon view is that if there's something you're passionate about and you want to explore something, in general, not much will happen if you give it a try. Sorry, not much will go wrong if you give it a try. If it doesn't work, you'll learn and you'll evolve and pivot into something else. But the learning journey, if you're really all into it, you'll find that next part. So if I take my own life after the first book, I thought I would be a circuit speaker, going around talking about the book. After about 20 or 30 of these, I got very bored of my own voice. And I realized I needed something deeper and much more interesting and fulfilling. And I sort of gradually flexed towards this idea of being an advisor, or as really helping leaders around these key inflection moments. That happened by learning and doing. I had to discover that, not design it. And so I think we should not be scared of the perfect answer, or scared of not having the perfect answer. We can just go with it, go for what we feel is interesting, but be open to that lifelong learning muscle. And that's the last chapter of the book, is how can we try and develop that learning orientation in what we do.
And who are some of the most interesting learners that you've encountered? Like, personally for me, I find that people who are just great at learning, one, tend to read quite broadly and read deeply. Second, they tend to speak with lots of people and are open to changing their minds as well. I keep finding these three common traits, but I wonder how you find in your conversations.
I think all those four behaviors really resonate with you. I think the bigger thing I'd also say is they redefine their role in life or in a career structure. So let's take, I know, I think both of us are tennis fans. Look at Roger Federer, right? He first of all, chapter one of his life, that first inflection moment was getting to professional, you know, levels, being respected. Second one was becoming a sort of champion, multiple Grand Slams. Then he sort of moved into the next inflection, which I think was being ambassador of the sport, right? Being a real icon. And then there was a final career inflection, which was kind of being almost a grandfather. He was kind of, you know, obviously past his full peak, but still was that kind of figurehead and that sort of steward of the sport overall. So in one person's life, maybe 20 years, there were four really quite marked inflection moments that he navigated. And I think he was able to see his role differently, his purpose differently, his way of contributing differently to the sport shifted. And that's why he was very successful. But as he made those inflections, he absolutely listened to lots of people. He had good people around him. He had space to reflect, all the things he talked about. They carried him through those things. But the first thing was realizing this was not a straight line. It wasn't about going from one Grand Slam to 50. It was about, there was a bit of that, but actually more of it was actually realizing the game had changed at different points in that curve.
Very well said. What would you like the readers to really remember after, you know, thinking about the book, consuming, digesting it? Any takeaways, highlights?
The key one is that this idea that not all time is created equal, that we often, you know, really sort of hustle, we're busy, we all have very manic lives. I'm sure you've had a busy day, as I have, but a lot of it is really recognizing that, you know, when you have these moments of inflection, we've got to stop a little bit and go a little bit slower to go faster later. So if we can take a little bit of time out to reflect, to really figure out that long-term piece, that medium-term piece, that short-term piece, and reconcile those different time horizons, so that the way we move really tries to have the best of all those three worlds, we're going to future-proof success. That's the key thing. And there's a lot in the book of how to do that, how to think about it, frameworks and tools. But at the core, the first thing is, you know, this idea that not all time is created equal.
And just the final question I ask authors before I open it up for our other members to do so is, writing a book is hard. You have to, you know, go through many hours of research, make up your own mind, and stick to a schedule. So in this particular process, what has been the most rewarding experience for you? And what has been something that you regret or felt you would have done differently?
So I think my first book I loved writing, but it was with a large publisher. I had a very good experience, but I often felt like I was writing the book for my editor. She was great, but I was often writing late at night in a dark room, knowing that she would review it and give me some comments a few months later. I didn't have a very clear idea of my audience, you know, and this time I had more freedom. I wanted to create my own imprint. It's called Intrinsic Press, and this is the first book under it. There'll hopefully be many more to come. And so I wanted to write this in a way that felt more authentic to me. And it was an inflection moment in my own writing career, actually. So I thought, look, I really love co-creating ideas. Why I love working with amazing leaders in organizations is that we learn together. So I wrote a lot of the book in snippets on LinkedIn. And the way that the book is structured is into micro chapters, actually. And I got so much feedback and so many views on the posts and ideas and comments that the book became so much richer. I also enjoyed the process of writing so much more because there was immediate feedback and usefulness, right? There wasn't waiting, you know, 2 years for a book to come out. Immediately people were finding the ideas and finding some parts useful, you know, giving me some very helpful critiques where the ideas could be strengthened. So I felt I wanted to be bold and brave. I don't think anyone's done that in the same way before. So that was quite nice. In terms of things that I'd done that do differently, there were different, I've never project managed a whole book before. So this, I became a sort of publisher. That was an interesting experience at times, and perhaps having a bit more support around me at times and planning for that better. So there are a few sort of hiccups here and there along the process, but I learned a huge amount from it as well. So yeah, I think a lot of times, you know, we think about what should we do differently. I knew I wanted to write a book and I loved writing, but how we write, we can fundamentally have an inflection moment in how we think about that as well. And that was my experience with inflection.
That's fantastic. And we didn't discuss too much about Intrinsic Press, but our timings are aligned. Even Network Capital is actually opening up its publishing, both for short form as well as for long form. So maybe we can collaborate on something. But how do people pitch to you? This is exciting. If people want to get published by Intrinsic Press, are you taking any inquiries?
I'm not trying to be a publisher of other people's work. I'm not. I don't think I'm good enough yet to, by any means, to get that point. But I, I had some great people around me help me with the editing of the book, the design, the audible recording, all of that stuff. And building that team was amazing. But yeah, for me, I want to be writing quite prolifically, and I hope it'll be a great vehicle. But anyone who wants to write, please reach out. I'm very happy to offer any tips or resources and things I find useful in the whole writing process as well.
Well, I recommend Sharad's work and his writing. I do hope all of you listening to it check it out. Thank you very much, Sharad. I look forward to meeting you soon.
Thanks, Sukash. Really great to have the conversation, as always.